Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 7th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Researching and Writing a Personal History, Session 3 of Company Towns in the Pacific Northwest, presented by Linda Carlson, number CAL 2003-03. Let's listen in.
My name is Linda Carlson, and you know that I'm here because I just finished this book, Company Towns in the Pacific Northwest. But I'm not going to talk about the book today, except in passing. What I want to talk to you about is researching and writing a personal history. And that might be a family history, it might be your own memoir, or it might be a community history, which is basically what this is. This is a collection of community histories. And it might be something like the history of a house, a summer camp, a school, or an organization, or even a business or a possession. For example, maybe there's some heirloom in your family and you'd like to track the history of it. Maybe it's not even that old. Maybe it's just been around for 50 or 75 years, but you want to talk about every house it's been in and everybody it's belonged to. So those are the kinds of histories that you might be doing. And what I'm going to try to do is go through some basic ideas as fast as I can and then give you a chance to ask questions, because I have an idea that most of you are here because you have something underway. Is that true? Oh, we always have some on. Okay. Number formats. Some people do things that are almost completely graphic. You could do something, like say you inherit a box of photographs. You could put something together that is nothing more than photographs with deep captions. And that would be something that I would call mostly graphics. So would something like a map with photos and other images, but very limited text. Now, how you might present it might be a scrapbook, might be a photo album, might be a book or a booklet, might be a folding presentation, you know, something like a zigzag book. It might be an oversized poster. It might be a timeline. It might be a website. It might be a slideshow, a CD, a PowerPoint presentation, or it might be some other electronic format. So there's all sorts of ways. There's nothing cast in stone. It doesn't have to be this. Although today, if you're doing something for more than a few people, you might want to consider something with the various print formats that are available fairly economically. But where do you start? I think when most of us start with any kind of a history, we start with a few fragments. And we decide that we want to flesh this out. We maybe have a few dates and a few names. Maybe we have part of a genealogy. Maybe we have memories of our own lives. Maybe we have snapshots. Maybe we just have odds and ends. Maybe you've cleaned out the attic of an elderly relative's house and you've got things that you want to know a little bit more about. So I think, at least that's been my experience, that most of us start with these bits and pieces. And I will tell you, when I started this book, I started with bits and pieces. And then I had lots of bits and pieces. And then what I wanted to do is what you probably want to do, and that is to, you have this skeleton, and maybe it's not a complete skeleton, but you want to make a complete skeleton, and then you want to flesh out the skeleton. You want to find out about the people for your own, for whom you may only have names, maybe you only have surnames, maybe you only have first names. And you want to fill in the gaps. You want to find the missing relatives or the missing information about careers or homes. Or increasingly today, you're looking for information on medical histories. And perhaps not for yourself, but to pass down to your children so that they have some sense of what they need to watch for. So that's what I think most people start with. There are a wide variety of resources that are available to you. You probably know about some. What I'm going to list are the kinds of resources that I used with this book and that I've used with some of the other things I've written. Most of us start with family stories, the jokes and the anecdotes and the personal tragedies. And certainly, that was one of the advantages of being able to interview so many people who had lived here at Holden, was you heard exactly that. You heard the funny stories. When I came last September for the miners' reunion, I heard a story that I had already seen mentioned someplace else, and that's about the man who filched the dynamite home in his lunch bucket just because he was digging out his basement. He got tired of digging. He thought he was going to blast out some of it. jam upstairs.
It's my understanding it was like applesauce or something really sticky. It was something sticky she canned.
She was canning in bottles, you know, jars. So you can imagine that that was a bit of a mess. And I think part of that story is in the book, because I was talking about where building materials came from, and I was referring to people who borrowed things from the company. But maybe you have a story like that in your family that you want to build on. Most people, I'm going to guess, most people have a family Bible, or somewhere in their family there's a Bible or there's some other record of family names. I happen to inherit the Bibles that were my Norwegian grandfather's, and there is no family tree in the Bibles. What there is his name in Norwegian. And because of that, because he, in this country, he used the name of his village, because the surname he used in Norway was in the Bible, when I started to dig through the census records, I was able to find him. So there's just, you know, three words that solved a problem. I would never have gotten to where I am today with family history had I not had that. There might be church records, like baptismal records, confirmation records, first communion records, marriage records, and it might be death records. I have never done a family history, but I will tell you I'm working on something now, because my son has to do a senior project, and as some of you know, parents often do a lot of these projects, and mother is trying to make sure he is pointed in the right direction, and I contacted a cousin of my mother's who made an effort to look up baptismal records for my grandmother, and we discovered that her name was different at the time of baptism than the name she used throughout life, and also her parents' names were different. Not only the surname was different, because of course it had not yet been Americanized, but the given name was different than what we thought it was. So you may have surprises like that too. A lot of people can use immigration records, for example, ellisisland.org and ship manifests. The thing about Ellis Island is it only works if your family went through Ellis Island. And what I have discovered is none of my relatives did. And ship manifests haven't gotten there. There might be birth records, there might be marriage records, death records, and county auditor and assessor's records. Where the assessor's records become very interesting is if you're trying to track down where someone lived. So that would be a source that you can look to. Obviously, citizenship papers are another valuable source of information. For one thing, it will show when a man was naturalized in this country, it showed if he had a wife and if he had children, and the papers that I saw for one of my grandfathers, it listed the children by name. There may be cemetery records. There may be census records, either online or at the National Archives. How many of you are from the Seattle area? Within, you know that the National Archives has a branch at Sandpoint.
Oh.
And it's, you can go in for free and use it. The 1930 census is now available, and the censuses before that, some of them are available by what's called Soundex. So if you don't know the exact spelling of the family name, you can go in and check by that. Now again, I will tell you, you might find some surprises. My cousin wrote and said, since you're going over there, would you check on our grandfather, the same one from whom I have the Bible? He and his brother ran a cabinet shop in Enumclaw. Well, I found his brother, and I found his brother's wife, and I found their address, but I have yet to find Grandpa. And he, at that time, was a bachelor. So we are suspicious, maybe he was camping out with some girlfriend or something. We aren't sure. But it's a mystery to me, and I will tell you that I had a very helpful census person helping me, and she thought it was a real mystery, too. But the cabinet shop existed in that time period, so somewhere we'll find him. But I point this out because it isn't real linear. You've got to be prepared as you're researching for all sorts of interesting projects and problems along the way. Another thing that's available, and it's available online, are homestead records. If you have a family member who got a true homestead grant from the government, that is available. and I believe it's the Bureau of Land Management where they find it. But you can go on the internet, type in Google that you're looking for homestead records, and you will find that. And I did find that for my husband's grandfathers, because they both did have homestead grants. I started my career as a newspaper editor, small town newspaper editor, and so when I'm looking for things, that's one of the first sources I go to. And again, for those of you in Seattle, Susala Library at the University of Washington has virtually all of the community newspapers on microfilm. So you can go in and read them. They are not indexed, so you have to have an idea of the dates that you're looking for. But just to give you an example of what I found when I do things like, I looked at birth announcements, I looked at marriage reports, I looked at what were called local news, which is where they would say, Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so had dinner with Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, and those sorts of things. I read a lot of obituaries, and I was, among other things, was reading advertisements, because I was looking to see how prices compared between towns like this and the outside world. And in most cases, I read with dates in mind. For example, I was reading to see what happened in World War I. I was looking to see what happened in World War II, and there were certain periods of the Depression. And I had identified periods that I wanted to know more about, because I had an idea after a while of when certain companies had shut down to the Depression and when they were starting up again. And so I was tracking activity. And in some cases, I was tracking people. But for example, I read the Friday Harbor Journal, which is the paper on San Juan Island. And I happened in my reading about World War II, I came across the birth announcement for the father of someone that my daughter went to school with. And of course, I also ran across the ad for the Roche Harbor company store, so I could see what they were selling. I was reading the Concrete paper because that served New Halem and Diablo, which are two of the towns in my book. And I ran into the obituary for the uncle of a friend of mine. And I ran into a report on the road to Diablo, which was very bad. And I also ran into a report on a man named George Redden, who I was familiar with because he spent most of his career as a logging camp missionary in Bend, Oregon. But what I didn't know was that he had started his career in the Washington area, and that he had actually been leading revival services in Concrete. So it's just a matter of chance. You're reading along and you just don't know what you're going to find. I don't advise that you all sit down and read 20 years of whatever paper unless you're very patient and you maybe only have one paper to read, because in those days sometimes the papers were only four pages, you know, front, back, and then the inside.
Are some of these papers trying to put their old the back copies on the internet? Is that's a huge task probably because it had to be scanned, or?
I don't think that'll happen, especially in most newspapers, because they're weeklies,
yeah.
And because some of them are not even in existence anymore.
Right, okay.
And what I have found increasingly is that the big papers have gone to these services where you can, they will index the title and the first 25 words, but then you have to pay one of these services for the rest of the story.
Right.
I see more of that, and I think it's because it's just gotten to be too big of a job.
Yeah.
I read the Polk County, Oregon paper because that's where I got, again, Chamber of Commerce reports on a road to a company town. I got stories on the baseball players. And if you were trying to track a family member and you knew that person might have played baseball in a certain time period on what we would call a rec league today, maybe you're going to do that.
Valsets?
This is for Valsets. And one of the stories, this was an example of why I was doing it. I was reading the Polk County paper very carefully because I wanted to see when Valsets shut down for the Depression and when they started up again. And that was one of the things I found. One of the more interesting things I found was an advertisement for Maytag washing machines with a note that you could have your choice of gas or electric motors.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read the book carefully, you'll see there's a reference to that. And of course, it was because many logging camps did not have electric power to the homes. And even here, people were running gas-powered washing machines during the war. I tracked a town called Kinzu, and for that, there wasn't a paper in Kinzu, I'm trying to remember what the closest paper was, but they had all sorts of things like a report when the Kinzu Mercantile was opening. Before they opened the store, they had a dance in the store, and it was reported in the Mr. and Mrs. kind of news. But again, it talked about the storekeepers, and it talked about how people were celebrating. And when I read the Bend paper, I found the obituary on George Redden, but perhaps more important for me by that time is it listed his survivors. So those were people I could contact for more information. Now, I hope that you all know the survivors for your family members, but I have talked to a few people here who've had some surprises. And when I was reading the DuPont paper, I found out about the World War I activities that were sponsored by the local church for the Doughboys over at Camp Lewis, which is something I didn't know about. Besides newspapers, you might turn to insurance records. In many museums, they're not museums really, they're archives. So you might find it at the Washington State Historical Society in Tacoma in the research center that's now on Stadium Way. Or you might find it at the University of Washington in special collections where they, or in the map room, where they have collected things. But for certain things, for example, for all the schools in a county, the insurance companies would come out and they would photograph the building, they would do a site plan, they would do a floor plan, and they would describe the building briefly. So for example, if you're looking for a picture of a school that someone might have attended, that would be a resource for you. And I will tell you that for Chelan County, there is a very complete record for the 1930s, except the Holden School. And it says in the front of the book that there is no information on the Holden School, for whatever reason. Then there are also school records, and the school records, by and large, are in the regional archives for whatever county you live in. And because I live in King County, and I was researching Pierce, well, I was researching as many counties as I could, but for Pierce, King, and Kitsap counties, I went to Bellevue Community College, which is where the regional archives are. When the information was done on the Holden School, the person involved went to Ellensburg, because that's where the regional archives are, is at Central. In general, the regional archives are on a campus. But you can look it up on the internet for the Secretary of State, and you will find them. Are there any of you from out of state? I would just start looking into where the county school superintendent's records eventually got put. And these are fascinating records. I started with the year 1900. These are handwritten reports by each teacher, and for each school, I should say. And most of the schools were one room, so it was one record per school. And then they were sent into the county school superintendent, and in this state, at least, they were eventually moved and put all together, so they are now in the county. But they, in this state, they had to record the names of every eighth grade graduate. So if you're looking for a family member, that might be a way to do it. And what I was looking for was to see how large the schools were and if there was any comment about ownership, because one of the things that interested me was whether the school was owned by a school district or by the community or by the company town. And for example, in Port Gamble, which was owned by what became Pope and Talbot, it says very clearly on the records, it listed all of the equipment in the classroom, and it said all the property of the Puget Mill Company, which was the forerunner of Pope and Talbot. So you find nuggets like that. You'll also find information on the length of term and what teachers made. I ran into somebody who was, you were talking about your grandmother having taught in Monte Cristo. So if you wanted to know what she made, and you could find the record from the Monte Cristo school, it would tell you. There are maps, and these can be tough to track down. When I was digging around in the map room at Susilo Library and the University of Washington campus, I was looking for maps of company towns, and most of them had been compiled for insurance purposes. But I was looking for site plans that showed how the timelines were laid out. And one of the things I found was the map for the neighborhood where I grew up. And again, it was probably an insurance record. But it was, I don't know, about this size, but there was a little black dot everywhere there was a house. So if you could decipher the street names, you could figure out exactly where your house was in an area which was at that time quite rural. And I'm going to guess it was done in the 1920s, and the house I grew up in had been built at that time. So one of the things I'd like to do for my parents is go back, find the map, and try to get a copy of that, because I think it would be interesting. Something else that's interesting are train routes, schedules, and fares. Particularly if you're having trouble finding a town that you can, that you know that it was positioned between two or three other communities, you may be able to find an old train schedule that shows it. These, what I worked from were the books that were put together for railroad employees, and they identified every stop and they identified the mileage between each stop and the time too. So, and then the other thing I did with train routes, I was very fortunate in having encountered via the internet some rail buffs. So these are people who gathered all this stuff, and you can post a question and people will answer your question. So for example, when I wanted to know how much it cost to go from Cedar Falls to Seattle on the railroad, somebody gave me that information. Something else that some of you will work with are military records. You may also work with city directories such as the R.L. Pope Gazetteers. There's a woman named Laura Grove whose father was Larry Penworthy, who provided many of the pictures that were taken of Holden in the late 30s. He came here as a young man and as a real photography buff. Well, when Laura and I were talking, she said she was trying to track down where her grandparents had lived in Tacoma. And I said one of the best sources for that is the R.L. Polk City Directory, because it tells, just as an R.L. Polk directory would tell today, for everyone, today it's everybody who has a listed phone number. But in those days, it was practically everybody. It went house number by house number and identified who was in the house at the time when the information was gathered. And it might not be accurate by the time the directory was published, but at the time. And in Tacoma, we have another source, which works if your home was among those of the rich, famous, or notorious. And that is that through the library, you can type in the address, and this is on the website, and it'll pop up information if there's ever been anything, any publicity or celebrity attached to your house. So that's another possibility. If you think that someone famous lived in your house, or if you think a terrible murder occurred in your house, research it that way. There are local and state historical societies, and there are state archives. And I went to these for a number of different things. For example, there was a village at a town called Beebe, and I had been told there was a school there, but I couldn't find any information on it. So I went to the local historical society, and someone did a little legwork. And basically, what she came back with was inconclusive. She said, yes, you're right, but I can't find out when. And we assumed it was a one-room schoolhouse that perhaps operated for only a brief period or perhaps was an on and off situation. Another thing that I went to the State Archives for was the issue of whether there had ever been a liquor store at Holden. You know, there's been some discussion about that, and I wanted to document once and for all in black and white that there had not been one. And so I went to the State Archives in Ellensburg, and it happened. The person I was working with had just received the State Liquor Board archives, and she went through them extremely carefully and documented the fact that there had never been a packaged liquor store up lake. Period. That is footnoted in the book, because there is another book that says there was a liquor store here. But that was a point that was very important to me. And again, it all depends on what you're looking for. But if you've got something that you either want to prove or disprove, these are some of the resources you can use.
Maybe that was a private liquor store.
You know, it wasn't illegal then. Some of the more offbeat sources that you may find are local radio programs and newspaper question and answer columns. One of the things that happened to me was, it happened, I was working at Bumbershoot, and I ran into somebody who was from Chelan, and I happened to mention I was working on this book, and he said, well, you should call radio station Cozy and get yourself featured on the program. So I contacted the radio station, and they had me on for I don't remember how long, but they said, is there anything you particularly want to know? And I said, yes, I want to know about Edgemont. the reputed brothel that existed 3 miles up lake. And I had two people call in, when one was the person who owns the site today, and another person had worked across the lake at what was then called Meadow Creek Lodge when the brothel was in operation. So there's information that I got that I would never have probably gotten any other way. I would certainly never have been reached by the person who owned the property.
Linda, on things like that, do you, if someone tells you that on personal knowledge, do you attempt to corroborate it?
Yes, I do.
So do you, if you have one other source that corroborates that you reported your book as a fact, or have, what level of proof do you need?
Well, the man who owns this currently owns the site, he was a pretty good source. He had, I think, actually worked here as a student, as a very young person. And he had owned the property since 1948.
Okay.
So he had owned it, the building burned. And in fact, I think he has something on the site, maybe a family cabin or something. So, and then the woman who had worked across the river provided a lot of other information. For example, she identified who she believed had owned the property at the time, and I went to a city directory to find, and so the information she gave me about that person, she said it was a Wenatchee music store owner, and I was able to find that person. So, you know, a lot of it is how much do you trust the information you're getting? And sometimes some things you check and double check because you just don't quite. And I will tell you, when I was working on McCleary, Washington, there were a lot of stories about Henry McCleary, who died shortly after, I'm trying to remember if he died during World War II or shortly after. So he's been gone a long time. And in the end, if you read the book carefully, you'll see it says, local legend insists that McCleary did X, Y, and Z. But there is no proof. But for example, the town was known to be wide open, moonshining, and supposedly Henry had a label. There was a label for the town's own moonshine. But you know, there is no label that exists today. So you just have to say, well, this is what people insist was the situation. On the other hand, the Ilma Historical Society found a light bulb that was stamped stolen from Henry McCleary. So apparently all the light bulbs in the lumber company were labeled, so if you took one home, that's what they looked. And that certainly tied into all the comments made about him. And another thing that I looked at were building floor plans and pictures. If you know anything about company towns, you know that people insisted that a lot of living conditions were squalid. And one of the ways I felt I could disprove that was by looking at what site plans were and what actual floor layouts were in the homes. And I was fortunate to have access to some of that. I mean, some of it, like Linda Jensen told me what her house looked like. When I came here, I was able to go through two of the chalets, and I was able to talk to the people who had lived in those chalets. One woman who was still alive, and then someone else, well, no, three people actually, three families, and then the other two families, they were people who were here as children, and they were able to describe their homes. So that helped. And then there are some other resources that you may be aware of. One is what a family history that is compiled where people pay to be listed. You've probably seen these big fat books. And like maybe every family has a page, and there's usually a picture, and the picture maybe wasn't the picture you would have picked, but somebody put it in. They are great to start with because they often mention where people lived, what they did for an occupation, or what the name of the business was, and they may provide dates and names of family members. For example, they'll often say things like, George and Martha were married on X date, and they were blessed with five children, the oldest of whom was George Jr., born on, and they just, you know, kind of rattle on, but there's a lot of great information. Then there are community histories, especially those that were done years ago. I like those because they emphasize what existed at that time and what was important to different communities. One of the resources that I used was, were, the WPA guides to the state of Washington, which were written during the Depression. It was a make-work project for writers. And it described every community that was in existence at that time, and it also made some asides about communities that were then almost out of existence, if you will. And I think in the book there's a quote from either Coal Creek or Newcastle, which the writer of the WPA guide dismissed as being a collection of broken down houses, because it was at that point. It was a coal town that had lost its industry. So those are things you might also want. It would be a great addition. If you were doing a family history, you could say, my family moved to community X in this year, and this is how the WPA guide described that town. And the WPA guides have been reprinted, but they are generally available in a library. And you might have to do an interlibrary loan to get one if you don't live in a big community.
What was the initials of those?
Hmm?
What did you call those?
It was, you know, I'll bet there's one for every state. It was, in our state, it was called something like Guide to Washington, the Evergreen State, but it was WPA Works Progress Administration Guide, you know, the Works Progress Administration during the Depression.
Okay.
It was one of the Make Work projects. And so what I would do in your community is I would go to your librarian and say, was there a state history, or it was, they were like kind of like guidebooks. I guess they went, they assumed you were starting at a certain point, and they just walked you through each community in order and ask if there was a WPA guide to your state. Or you could probably even just type in WPA guides and see what comes up. Genealogical societies can be a great resource even if you're not really a buff, because they can help you, that they can help provide information that you might need. One of the things I found when I was digging through the Norwegian census information on the internet was a guide to naming practices in early Norwegian families, how the first son was named for the paternal grandfather, and the first daughter was named for one of the grandmothers.
Right.
And that was important for me because of one family, you had to search by first name because they hadn't used surnames. Surnames weren't mandatory until something like 1925.
I think so.
So that's where some of these articles from the societies become real helpful. And they might also have some information on a community that you might not have otherwise. And then, of course, the internet. The internet is helpful because of the current phone directories, because of the genealogical listservs, because of the local histories that people have contributed, and many online documents. One of the things I found online that was not good enough to print, and in fact it was hard to use, but it's still incredibly valuable, was a map that some railway buff had created of all of the logging railroads in Oregon. And so I was looking for information on a town called Never Still. That seemed appropriate for a logging town. But it was important because it tied in other ways. I go to church at Queen Anne Lutheran. On Queen Anne, we have Cary Park. And Cary Park is named for Albert S. Click Cary, who headed the corporation that built the Four Seasons Olympic Hotel in downtown Seattle, which is on the site of the original University of Washington campus. But at some point in his career, Cary lost his money and went to Oregon and started up a rail line called the Cary Line, which ran so many miles, and it served about a dozen logging camps, and it terminated at Never Still. And so there were a lot of reasons why I was looking for that information. And at least I got a sense of where Never Still was. I didn't get any other information, but this was an online map that was very helpful. When I say current phone directories, are you all familiar with something called the Axiom database? Okay, if you have a Seattle or King County public library card, and I'm sure this is true in many other public libraries, many libraries subscribe to databases, especially of phone directories, because then they don't have those books in the library anymore. And what we do in Seattle is you log on to the library site, you put in your library card number, you say, I want to see databases, and then you get to pick. And Axiom, which I think is, it's either ACXIOM or it's AXCIOM. You can type in a name. For example, I typed in my grandfather's surname as he used in this country, and I was astounded to find out how many people by that name came up in this country, because we didn't know of anybody besides ourselves. And I know that some people use that as a way of tracking down relatives when they're just doing a search. So that might be something that you would want to use. I decided to pursue Albert S. Carey, and I looked for his children in Seattle. And unfortunately, the person I found was probably the right name, because it was A.S. Carey Jr. The phone had been disconnected by the time got to him, and I'm assuming that that would have been a very elderly man, and so probably he'd gone to some other sort of facility rather than the home. Okay, so that's resources, and I'll be glad to answer questions about that later, but I want to move on and talk to you a little bit about writing, since I only have a few minutes left. The most important thing to me when I'm writing is, as Peggy mentioned, accuracy and completeness. I want to acknowledge legend, but I want to document if I can prove it untrue or if I can believe it might be inaccurate. One of the stories I was always told as a child by my grandmother was that she had been sent at the age of 4 to live up on the fjord with an aunt who had recently lost her child. And I'd always assumed that it was a child that had been lost. But when I started digging through census records, and then I also finally got access to a family tree, I found out this was a woman in her mid-20s who had died. She was the daughter, but she had never married. Perhaps it was a health reason she never married. She stayed at home and died in her mid-20s. And yes, her parents were bereaved and had taken in my grandmother, who was the middle child between two sets of twins. And when you look at the birth date for the twins, you realize this was probably why she was shipped off, because there were twins who were 8, there was a child, my grandmother, who was 4, and then there was a set of twins who did not live very far into childhood. So here was a ship captain's wife alone with 5 kids, and it was probably easier to send one off while she tended to these sickly little boys. But that's something that now I'm glad to know and to document, that it was indeed, she was going to older people. I think you need to acknowledge different spellings and variations of names up front and decide how you'll handle them, and then be consistent. And certainly, if I do anything with my maternal grandmother, where I have now discovered the name she used throughout life was not her baptismal name, I'm going to document that. I use full names, including maiden names for women and possibly people's parents' names. Note the spelling variations and any name changes that have resulted because of marriage, adoption, or divorce. And often you have situations where children have been farmed out and they have ended up adopting the name of the foster parents. Or I have a cousin who, her parents were married only briefly, and the name from her father is very long, and she used the surname of her mother's second husband her entire life. One of the things I think is really important is, if you are talking about sites, for example, where your house was, make sure you talk about, when you say, and this is what's on that site today, make sure you date that comment. For example, say something like, by 2003, our old house was still standing, but by then it had been converted to a church and then to a store. Because you don't know what's going to happen 5 or 10 years down the road. And I can tell you, I've read lots of little homemade histories where people say, on the site today is X, and 20 years later, on the site today is Costco, or Best Buy, or asphalt parking lot. So, and I would encourage you to document your sources so that other people can follow up on the research that you did, or they can continue your project, or they can understand where your inconsistencies came from. Second thing I think is important is that you be organized. The format that you use will help determine how you organize your material, but you might start out by choosing a chronological format. That's what a lot of us like to use. You might choose family branches, and that might be geographic or it might be genealogical. It might be a theme, and that's basically what I did in this book. Where we lived and how we furnished our homes might be one theme. What we ate, There's an entire book on how America ate in the previous century. Where we went to school, where we worked, where we attended church, the special occasions that we remember, where we shopped, our pets and our friends. You might choose any of those, and they might become mini chapters in a personal memoir. We were sitting on the ark today talking about another way, and that is the sitting, looking around our houses and remembering what furnished or what appliances were used in the houses that we grew up in. And for example, somebody that we went to church with said, well, we had a wood stove that we used until World War II was over. And I said, I can beat that. We have, in my parents' home, the wood stove that my grandmother had in her kitchen until 1957. And then it went to the summer, what was then a summer cabin, and today it is in their house. And it's partly there because they continue to have power outages. But you could build an entire story about the wood stove and when it was acquired and why it was acquired and you know what it's used for today. And you could talk about the first home you remember. You could talk about how erratic phone service might have been. We were talking here about how people made long distance calls. You could talk about what you paid for phone service and how you got long distance. I mean, those are all things that every one of us in this room probably experienced differently from what those kids out here are going to experience. And that's something else I think you should do, is record what was meaningful to you in a way that will be of interest or value to your readers. I would encourage you to explain things that you remember that children, today's children, may not have anything, any knowledge of. For example, rationing, living without indoor plumbing, living without cell phones. My son, who is 17, once said to me, what do you mean they didn't have a phone up at the lake? They didn't even have a car phone? You know, and I talked to my daughter about the fact that we had to wear dresses to school. It's just like, she doesn't believe it. Some of us were laughing about manual typewriters, and that's how many of us learned to type. You know, Visa cards, we take them for granted today, but you really, it hasn't been that long. And personal computers and the internet, you know, it's not that you have to talk about what life was like before them, but you could say, for example, when I went off to college, my parents bought me a Smith Verona portable, and then you're going to have to explain that was a Smith Verona portable typewriter, and that's what you used with erasable paper because they hadn't invented whiteout. Maybe you didn't have erasable paper. But those are the things, you know, that 20 years from now might be really interesting, and even today might be interesting to grandchildren or other younger people. I would also encourage you to try to anticipate what will be of interest to people. There are three things that I've thought a lot about, and I wish I knew. My grandfather, as I was telling Andreas earlier, my grandmother went home to Norway when she was pregnant with my dad. And so in the fall of 1924, with a baby in arms and two older children, this woman, who was 5 feet tall and weighed 100 pounds, had to get on a train, go the length of Norway, get on a boat, come across the Atlantic, get on a train, and bring three children and diapers all the way to Tacoma, Washington. How did she do it? How did she do diapers? I'm assuming there was no formula. I'm assuming she was breastfeeding. But how did she do it? My other grandmother came home one day during the Depression. She'd taken her kids downtown for something, and her house had burned down. What did she do? I know they lived in the garage. I know that the oldest uncle, who was barely 20, rebuilt the house. But what was it like? How did they do it? How did they live in the garage? What would you do when you walked home and here's your house smoldering on the corner? And the other thing that I wish I knew, and I broached the point to my father, and he was too emotional to talk about it, is have some of you seen the old Saturday Evening Post cover that showed a GI returning from the war? It's a tenement neighborhood, and everybody's hanging out the window waving as Joe GI comes home. I said, what was it like when you came home? And he couldn't tell me. And I think they probably had some warning, but my grandparents didn't have a phone. So what if, did they get a telegram saying he had landed in California and was coming? But those are the kinds of stories that some of you have that are could be incredibly valuable. And if you would just jot them down or record them, or post the question to anybody who might know. I mean, for example, my grandparents have been dead now for a long time, but we did have someone who had her parents had homesteaded next to my grandparents, and maybe she would have remembered what it was like when my grandmother arrived back in Tacoma with these three kids. But Anna didn't ask.
I'm wondering if when you were interviewing people, especially about things in their family history or whatever, that would you use a tape recorder or would you just try to write things down, or how would you get the flavor of your stories?
Well, let me remind you that I started out as a newspaper reporter, so I take notes. And I don't tape people because I find it intimidating to be taped myself. But I think for some of you, if it doesn't intimidate people, it would be a wonderful thing to do because you can get everything. You know, if you get interested in a story and you forget to take notes, I'm pretty organized, and I usually have a list of questions, and I'll go back and say, now, wait a minute, I really enjoy the story, but we got to get back here. But if your subject does not mind being taped, I would sure encourage you to do it. And for some people, maybe you can set up a videotape and just let it run, and it's off to the side, and if it's mic'd properly, maybe you're going to pick up enough, and then you'll also have some images. But it is very important to take careful notes. The extreme weakness that I have is that I do have very messy handwriting, and sometimes I go back and I can't figure out what I was trying to write. So that's something that would really help if you had a tape. And I would also encourage you to include images, even if they aren't of your family directly. And for example, if I were writing a family history, here's some of what I might include. And some of these are family-specific images, and some of them aren't. I would include scans of the Norwegian census records that show my grandfather's childhood homes. I would include pictures of the houses, even modern day, or if I could find them, at the time my grandfather lived there. I would include a map showing the seaside community where my grandfather was born, and I would show how far it was from the larger community where he went into school and where they eventually moved. I would show a scan of the city directory showing the cabinet shop in Enumclaw. I'm sure I can find the address for the Enumclaw cabinet shop, even if I can't find him. I would include pictures of the kinds of cars that my father remembers my grandfather and my uncle driving. And even if those aren't the cars they owned, but it could be advertisements from that time period, or it could be pictures that you get from books on cars of the period. I might include a picture of the corner grocery where my dad was occasionally sent, or maybe an ad from that grocery if I could find it in the local paper. I have access to my father's third grade school class picture on the steps of Parkland Grade School, and I have a picture of myself taken in the same thing, third grade steps of Parkland Grade School.
When do you have to worry about copyrights? Because this is more home production, I guess. Mm-hmm. And, at one stage, you probably have to worry about getting credit and so forth.
Mm-hmm. You would have to worry about copyright if you're going to publish anything. You have to get permission.
Right.
And the ads is probably not an issue because copyright is probably expired, especially if you're doing something like a 1930s vehicle.
Right.
But if it's a picture out of a book of a car,
right,
you know, it's Andreas's collection of 1930 Essexes, then I would have to be concerned. But maybe you're going to a car show and you're walking along, you say, this is the kind of car I remember my dad talking about. Yes.
Hmm.
Take a picture. It's yours. Something else you might say would be school report cards, draft induction notices, discharge papers, or scan of a military medal. I might include a picture of a downtown Tacoma street right after World War II, when both of my grandmothers had a little bit more money and a little bit of time, and so they did more shopping. And what I would do is pencil in the names of the different stores that were there then. In those days, they had roving photographers, people who walked the streets and took pictures of people and then sold them the prints, and I have at least one print of my grandmother in one of those situations where she's walking down the street with a friend dressed up. So that would be the kind of thing that would be fun to have inset with the map. And something else I would include if I could, and there's a family tie, but it's not a family piece, and that would be a token from the bus company where my mother had her first job. And I remember her saying that when she got out of high school, she got hired for the bus company, and it was X number of dollars plus your tokens, because she got to ride to work for free. So there's a little bit of a family history there. So those are the kinds of things that I would be doing if I weren't writing books, I were writing history. And I hope that gives you some ideas, and if you have questions, I'll be happy to ask them.
I'm wondering if you have any tips for drawing out family members who might, for whatever reason, not talk much about their history, if there's ways that might help them be more forthcoming.
Well, certainly that's what happened to my family. I didn't think to ask, and they were so busy in the present that they never talked about those things. It's always wonderful if you have an excuse. My son and I interviewed my father because I said, Eric has to do a Boy Scout genealogy badge. So that was the excuse there. And you could make up a story. You could say you're taking this class at the local community college on family history and you need a nugget from each one of your elderly relatives. You could start with medical history. You could say that your doctor has told you that you need to get an idea of what major diseases each family member suffered and what the cause of death was. Or you can take something that you remember being told and saying, I want to know more about this. Or you can buy this book in the bookstore and take it and say, this woman talked about what life was like in places like Holden during the Depression. What was life like for you during the Depression or during World War II or whatever? I mean, one of the great stories that my mother-in-law told, which ties in here, or has a tie, is she talked about being the night operator at the local telephone company when she was in high school, and she had a cot and she slept by the switchboard. And there's a story about a boy who did that in Riderwood. But you could say, you know, just out of curiosity, what were your first jobs? And I think, as I said, you start with fragments. So you just get started and then move out. Or there's all sorts of books, by the way, on interviewing family members, and you might start with one. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Are personal income tax or social security records accessible, or are they not unless you're the person whose records they are?
I don't think they are.
What about property tax records?
Yes, because remember I said the assessor's office?
Social security is for 40 years old or something like that. Social Security, where you could look up, I think it's 40 years. You can't get any current Social Security records, but you can from 40 years and older.
You bring up a good point, though. You can get the Social Security death records. If someone was collecting Social Security at the time of death, or the family put in for a Social Security death benefit, that is current. It's within 18 months. And how I have accessed that is through Ancestry.com. You can go in because the Social Security Administration itself doesn't provide the index, but there are other services that do. And again, I went in and I plugged in my grandfather's name to see who all by that name had existed. And I've also done a situation, I hate to tell you this, but when I was interviewing for this book, people would say, oh, you need to talk to so-and-so. Well, they couldn't locate so-and-so. In a couple of cases, I went and plugged the name in to see if so-and-so had died. So,
it's not too bad.
Well, it's kind of maudlin. But you mean you wanted to know what people made?
No, I guess I was just thinking when you said you couldn't locate where your grandfather was in that
period of time, I was wondering, well, who paid the property taxes, who was filing income, well, that was before probably personal income tax issues, and before Social Security, too.
And here's the other twist. My mother's father, who deserted the family during the Depression, I wanted to track down when he died. He's not listed in the Social Security records. And it's because that's where I found something that explained that until the early 50s, if you were self-employed, you were not, apparently, were not paying Social Security taxes, and you were not eligible for benefits, I guess, but you're not in if you were self-employed, and then the farmers were not either. So there were all sorts of people who were outside that system. But as far as property tax, you could go and look back and see, as long as you have the legal description of a piece of property, you can go back and see what the taxes were.
It's amazing what happens on the internet. My son was putting together a memorial thing for his dad. My husband died in December. And he wanted a insignia from his Navy uniform from back in the Korean War. So he puts this little thing on the internet. I don't know where he went on the internet. He didn't tell me that. But you know, does anybody out there happen to have? And what did you know, the next day some old sailor in North Carolina Island near Seattle says, yeah, I do. I went up my attic and found my uniform. I'll send it to you. And say, he said, you, I don't want the uniform back, but save the patch on the other side and send it back to me. So,
wow.
You know, my son took that and went off and put it on a cap and mailed it back to him. But I mean, it was amazing. It was like the next day.
Well, there's probably artwork for those insignias that's available on the internet. So you could have just printed.
You can also
off.
Get copies of the medals that people receive in the service. Same thing.
You can probably find out if someone won a medal, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe somebody always claimed to be the recipient of a certain kind of medal.
Yeah, they'll give you the whole.
And wasn't.
Was there interesting?
I don't think you mentioned the Mormon Church. Are they a good source for?
They are. The Mormon Church has done significant work on. I wanted to really focus on things outside the usual genealogy things, but the Mormon Church is a great resource. The issue is that their records are not local. What you have to do is buy the reels of microfilm from them.
Okay.
Or if you're going to Salt Lake or Provo or wherever it's headquartered, you can get them. But they do have some records. In fact, there are some Norwegian records that the Mormons transcribed.
Okay.
Because I was on looking in the Norwegian censuses right before I came.
Mm.
And there was information about things they had provided. So I do know there is one man who grew up here who got started on genealogy when it was his son's genealogy merit badge. And he went through some information that the Mormon Church had provided, and it was not accurate.
Okay.
And so he was under the assumption that maybe, he said it depends on whatever volunteer was transcribing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps they transcribed the names wrong, the spellings wrong.
I was recently trying to fill in some current family. And I had a family sort of genealogy from an uncle. And I ended up writing letters to anonymous people because all he had was a city. So I would go onto the internet, get the address, or get, you know, look for names. And I wrote letters that said something, if you are who I think you are, this is your grandmother, this is your grandfather, and we're having a family reunion. And I ended up adding over 300 names to live relatives, and because I would follow up by a phone call if I didn't get any answers, and found people that thought they had no relatives at all, and it was really cool, but I'm sure there were people who thought it was pretty weird getting a letter in the mail, but it worked.
Well, it's great, and you know, I was talking about going through the phone book.
Uh-huh.
My grandfather's, the village name was Spanus. And in this country, most of the family members spell it with a W, so it's Swanus. Well, I had run into, it was one of those things. My cousin wrote me an email and said, send me everything you have on family history. My grandson's doing a school project. And so as part of that, I typed in Swanus into Google, and a lot of information came up, and I ran into this guy in the Dakotas, who's apparently a farmer and has lots of time, no kids.
And so I contacted him and said, you know, are we related? And he wrote back and said, yeah, I think we are. And then the last thing I heard from him, we've been corresponding via email for a couple of years, is I just ran into somebody named Hadland. Hadland is the village across from Skaunas, who has a family history back to the year 1000. And I have run into somebody. Somebody had said, contact this person in Ballard. Well, she was too elderly to provide any help, and she said, contact so-and-so. Well, so-and-so lived in Norway, but I put his name into Google, and up came his daughter's name and email address. So I emailed her, and I had gotten the family history back to 17-something. But then the funny part about this Hadland was I said to this fellow, oh, I didn't know the Hadlands were interested in genealogy. And in fact, I didn't even know that Hadland was still alive. And he wrote back, and I said, P.S., I'm assuming these are the Hadlands of Tacoma. And he wrote back, no, they're the ones in Wisconsin. So it's a completely different branch of the same family that I didn't know about. So you know, again, as I say, you have to be organized, and you just have to be open to everything you're going to find. And I think it's lots of fun putting those pieces together, and it'll never be 100% complete. But what you've got now is so much more than what you have. Mm-hmm. And each one of those people may have a story. And, you know, here again, coming back to your question, is you may be able to go to people around the person that you're trying to profile and ask, say, for their memories of that person, or what do you remember doing as a child with this person? That might help you, too. So, we probably have to go.
Thank you.